Case number 20-5688, United States of America versus Mickey Reif. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Inman, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, learned counsel. My name is James Inman. I'm court appointed counsel for appellant Mickey Reif. I've asked to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal concerns the constitutionality of 2423C as applied to appellant Reif. He conditionally pled guilty based on sexual contact that he had with two minors while living in Cambodia, where he resided. More importantly, the case presents issues of what it means to be sovereign and the scope of Congress's police powers. Only the states possess a general police power, and the federal government does not, as we're instructed in Morrison. This circuit has addressed this issue in the context, has addressed the statute in the context of a prior panel decision, the al-Maliki decision, which addressed constitutional concerns under the Foreign Commerce Clause. Unfortunately, in that case, the appellant did not preserve the issue, and it was reviewed under plain error. In deciding that case, the previous panel noted that there was a split in the circuits, and thus it could not find that there was plain error. But again, if the al-Maliki panel had decided that the issue was, or that the that panel was bound by other decisions of the circuits that had decided the issue, it would have applied that law. Of course, the Sixth Circuit is not bound by the decisions of other circuits. The district court below, instead of addressing the Foreign Commerce Clause issue that was presented, decided that that subsection C was constitutional under the treaty power as implemented by the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution. And essentially what the district court said is that 2420.
Before we go through that, can I ask you a question on why exactly do you claim that the Foreign Commerce Clause doesn't have a more expansive ambit than the Interstate Commerce Clause, particularly here? And we're in a situation in which the other country's sovereigns have asked for us to participate. No one has objected. They're all signed on to this optional protocol. Why isn't, give me your position on why that doesn't matter here.
So there are two powers that your question has implicated here, and plainly, Mr. Reif's conduct was non-commercial conduct. So the Commerce Clause doesn't reach it at all. If you look at the text of this clause in the Constitution, it uses the term commerce that applies both to all three of the interstate commerce, foreign commerce, and commerce with Indian tribes. However, with respect to foreign commerce and Indian and commerce with the Indian tribes, they use the word with instead of among. So I know that there's a tendency to borrow from interstate commerce clause case law, but the issue is what the difference between with and among means. That's where we start from. If you look back at what the framers were intending when the Constitution was drafted, the word among is chiefly to designate the federal government's scope of activity between commerce between the states. So the idea of federalism is born out of the idea of sovereignty of the states to decide issues within their boundaries.
But isn't that limited here? We don't have that federalism concern here because we're in the foreign commerce. Right. So the question becomes, are we stepping on their toes? Well, and it seems to me that we're not stepping on their toes. We've been invited and asked to participate.
So to the first point, the issue with the Commerce Clause is that we have not been invited to in this particular instance. So the treaty that is supposedly implemented, the optional protocol, deals only with commercial sex crimes, child prostitution, child slavery, and trafficking. These are all commercial aspects of this treaty. There's a separate treaty that the United States expressly did not join, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that would touch on child sex abuse that doesn't have a commercial component. And we are not party to that treaty, and we've resisted joining that treaty.
Well, I'm struggling with where your answer's going, because we have such a long history of recognizing that commerce can be impacted by even local activities, all the way back from Wickard in the 40s and Raich in 2005. Those were claims of only local activity. And yet, both of those were considering the impact, whether there is, I think we say, whether Congress has a rational basis for concluding that the activity would have a substantial effect on commerce. That's Raich. Why doesn't that answer the question here?
Well, let me go back to the issue about federalism is the issue of sovereignty. We call it federalism, but it's the sovereignty of the states. The same issue of what can you do within the boundaries of a sovereign entity applies here. What can you do within the boundaries of a sovereign foreign nation? And the fact of the matter is that the applicable case law here is Morris and not Raich. So Wickard and Raich both deal with a fungible commodity, wheat and marijuana, that doesn't have anything to do with a sexual act. Even in, you know, from the time of Wickard, the view of the Commerce Clause was quite expansive, but that was reined in by Lopez. Lopez says the Commerce Clause is not without limits. And then in 2000, when Morrison was handed down, the court told us that you cannot aggregate violent offenses. These would be considered violent offenses for purposes of the Commerce Clause. This is not a situation in Raich. They're looking at regulation of drugs, basically. They're not looking at the criminal aspect of marijuana possession. In fact, if marijuana had been legal, if it had been not been a crime to possess marijuana, Raich would have been decided the same way, because Congress can regulate drugs and interstate commerce.
I don't want to interrupt your point here, Mr. Inman. Let's say that the executive reaches agreement on a treaty regarding the rights of women. And so the signatories to that agree that they're going to have certain minimum protections and standards regarding the rights of women in their respective countries. And assume further that this obligation itself requires the United States to enact, among other things, a law identical to the Violence Against Women Act. All right, and this is after Morrison. Would Congress then, because a country has invited us to do this, to regulate our citizens in a particular manner, does that mean that the Congress in this example would then, under Congress's power to enact laws necessary to carry out treaties, would Congress then be able to do under this clause what the Supreme Court said it cannot do under the Commerce Clause?
No, it cannot. And what you're raising is a concern that was raised by Justices Scalia, Alito, and Thomas in the Bond case. It's basically bypassing the Supreme Court's authority to rule on constitutional issues. The Supreme Court says,
I mean, isn't it bypassing the whole idea that the Constitution prescribes a government of limited powers?
Exactly.
I mean, that's really the backstop here. It's not federalism. I mean, you know, federalism, you know, there are provisions of the Constitution that allow federalism to arise, but I mean, we're enforcing the Constitution itself at the end of the day.
Right. And the minute that words were put to paper to limit the federal government is where the limit arises. The decisions we're talking about say the same thing. The fact that
Council,
the idea,
how do you reconcile your position, though, with Missouri v. Holland? Are you just saying that was a wrongly decided case?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of
Missouri v. Holland.
Yes.
Which I believe the Supreme Court recognized in that case that there could be a treaty to regulate something that Congress wouldn't necessarily have the power to regulate on its own.
Right.
Isn't that what that case stands for?
I don't believe so. The treaty power is not a power of Congress. The power that's really used here is the necessary and proper clause. And there are limits to that power. But I mean, it has to be necessary. It has to be related to whatever treaty that it's implementing. And proper includes that the law, the statute that is enacted by Congress fits within the spirit and the letter of the Constitution. So if the Constitution
is this law necessary to the treaty here? The treaty is to prevent commercial exploitation of minors.
Right.
Granted, this was not commercial, but why couldn't you say, though, having a legal climate of no American citizen abroad should be engaged in sexual conduct with minors? Why isn't that rationally related to the treaty here?
Well, we're taught in Morrison that you can't relate those things. It's not an economic issue. And the power to act in the hands of Congress has to come from some power that's expressed in the Constitution.
Right. Mr. Inman, let's say that the executive, goes off in a flyer and agrees to a treaty that in effect requires the passage of bills of attainder against certain people in the United States. All right. Is that a quote valid treaty within the meaning of Justice Holmes' terse to the point of cryptic sentence in Missouri v. Holland?
I don't believe so.
And why is it not a valid treaty?
Well, even in this context where we're looking at the commercial crimes that are involved with this treaty, you could take this extension of jurisdiction or authority over citizens abroad and apply it to citizens domestically. We don't have to find a crazy hypothetical to look at the danger here. So where the federal government doesn't already have the power to criminalize this conduct, a purely domestic sexual mm-hmm. abuse or sexual molestation crime, and it doesn't do that, using the treaty power, it could bypass those restrictions here. And I see that I'm out of time.
That's okay. Judge Strantz, did you have a question you were looking to ask?
No, I think we can pick it up on the book.
Very well. All right, Mr. Inman, thank you. You'll get your rebuttal. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Sonia Ralston for the United States.
Good morning.
I'd like to start with the concept of federalism versus sovereignty and talk a little bit about international law and how that plays into what we're talking about there. The Constitution at its framing was mediating the relationship between the states and the newly formed federal government. Foreign sovereigns are not a party to that relationship. International law serves that mediating function between foreign sovereigns. And this
right. Now you would agree that the Constitution also was, I mean, its principal purpose actually was to limit the powers that this new federal government had. You would agree with that, right?
Actually, I disagree. I think the point of the Constitution was to expand on the powers that the federal government was granted under the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, sure. Of course, as compared to the pittance that the federal government had under the Articles of Confederation. But I mean, here we're coming out of the framers have just emerged from this struggle in which they rejected the claims of Parliament to absolute power, unlimited power. And the problem there was the British Constitution, as great as it is with its internal dynamics, they didn't write down the limits on government power. And so then Parliament presumes to assert what it called sovereignty, which is absolute power. And so let me just ask you again, because this would be an extraordinary position, I think, for the government to take. Would you agree, it's not a relative question about the powers under the Articles of Confederation. Would you agree that the Constitution limits the powers of the government that that operates under that kind, under the, you know, the federal government? It limits those powers. It's granting, but also circumscribing the powers of the federal government.
Yes, and certainly in the domestic sphere, that's true. But one of the main purposes of the Constitution is to give the federal government plenary power over international affairs. That was one of the key problems they were trying to solve, right?
But it doesn't, is it the government's position that the federal government has in fact absolute power over Americans when they leave the bounds of this country by way of this treaty power and et cetera?
I think it depends on the facts of the situation, but I think it's not inconceivable.
Absolute power. They could prescribe any rule of conduct whatsoever with respect to Americans overseas, and that's okay.
It would depend on whether, you know, there are structural things there about the two-thirds advice and consent, the willing treaty partner of a foreign nation, international law consistency, the explicitness of extraterritoriality.
Could you give an example of any instance where the government could not agree to something internationally that would affect an American citizen? Is there any example of anything that you would say that would go too far as the treaty power is concerned?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Reed versus Covert. The federal government cannot enter into a treaty that derogates the rights protected by the Bill of Rights. So Reed versus Covert is a case about the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, the rights to criminal procedure. And the Supreme Court held there, this is again building on what's talked about in Riggs in the 19th century, that the power is limited. This is what it means to be a valid treaty, right? It can't override the express limitations.
Okay.
Would you agree that the federal government could enter into any treaty to criminalize any conduct of any American citizen? Is there any instance where there's any kind of a crime that the federal government could not agree to under the treaty power to criminalize for an American citizen abroad?
Certainly, I think it would be a very close question if there were some First Amendment type crimes, things that are in fact illegal in other countries that are protected by the First Amendment. Anything that would be implicated, I don't think you criminalize, you know, providing counsel to terrorists or something like that. So I think, you know, if you're talking about the Bill of Rights, yes. If you're talking about, that we're not allowed to send our agents into foreign countries uninvited. So if another country is unwilling to assist or allow the prosecution, it wouldn't matter what the statute says, right? We can't be sending FBI agents to countries that don't want us.
Follow up on that question. As I understood the first part of your answer, Ms. Ralston, to Judge Bush, you agreed that a treaty is not valid if the government is agreeing to exceed the limits of its constitutional powers, I think is what you said just now. Is that a fair paraphrase?
So, yes, but I think we may understand what those limits disagree about.
I bet we do. And that's fair. No, I understand that. Apart from, affirmative rights that are granted under the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the enumerated powers that are granted, say, under Article 1, or even the president's powers vested under Article 2, those, we can all agree that those have some boundaries, right? I mean, like, you know, the interstate commerce power has some boundaries. The Foreign Commerce Clause has some boundaries. The court hasn't really spelled those out in the same way, but they have some boundaries. And so if the president, let's say those boundaries, you know, under the Foreign Commerce Clause, those we'll call those boundaries X. And the president then enters into an agreement where he agrees to regulate the conduct of American citizens overseas to the extent of X plus 10. So, I mean, isn't the treaty then invalid with respect to the plus 10 part, to the extent it's exceeding the power of Congress to regulate citizens overseas? There's no, unless I'm missing something, there doesn't seem to be any power vested by the Constitution into one of the branches that allows the government to do to United States citizens the plus 10 part.
Okay, I understand your question. I think the answer is that the treaty power combined with the necessary and proper power are the power vested in both the president and the Congress to effectuate the whole realm of international relations, to make diplomacy effective.
But and the treaty is only valid to the, I guess this is really an interesting case because it's about first principles, you know, and it's not often we get to write on a slate that is as clean as this one is. But it would seem to me that the treaty power is a power of the president, initially at least, to enter into agreements under which the federal government agrees to exercise its constitutional powers in certain ways. We might agree that pursuant to the commander-in-chief power, we're going to have 100,000 soldiers in Okinawa. And through the appropriations power, we're going to pay a certain amount of money to the Japanese government each year. And we might have another treaty where we, you know, lower tariffs, or we agree to provide certain aid in exchange for some benefit. All of these are exercises of actual, you know, enumerated constitutional powers. But it would seem like that the executive, at least without lawfully, at least, can't agree to do something that's beyond those powers, to enact the Violence Against Women Act here in the United States. I mean, the hypothetical I mentioned earlier. I mean, would you agree that treaty? Let's say we have a treaty that is just like we're gonna enact the Violence Against Women Act in the United States. We really want to get that done. The court struck it down. We have found a willing treaty partner, and we're going to have this reciprocal agreement. Each of us is going to pass this. So now we go back. So now can Congress lawfully, pursuant to this, you know, power to enact laws necessary to carrying out a treaty, can they basically overrule Morrison and enact that law? That's what I'm driving at. And it seems to me that when you talk about plenary power, you're kind of assuming that the executive has this like absolute power to enter into treaties and everything's valid. And then Congress can do whatever it wants, short of violating like something in the Bill of Rights. But I'm suggesting that the government can't go beyond, it can't be valid if it goes beyond. So let me just, I'm sorry for the speech. It's kind of a long setup. But so what do you think about that Violence Against Women treaty and that hypothetical?
Okay, so I think I have three responses. The first is that under Missouri versus Holland, yes. And I think that's exactly what the treaty at issue in Holland is. It's dealing with something that's purely intrastate that couldn't be passed absent the treaty, but because of the treaty, it can. Second, even if you think the Violence Against Women Act treaty is on the other side of the line, you could draw a line between treaties that deal in their subject matter with internal matters and with a problem that is global in nature. The treaty here deals with a global problem, the sex tourism, sex trafficking, child exploitation problem that by its nature crosses international boundaries. So that treaty is very akin to the treaty in Holland, where we're talking about the birds that are migrating back and forth across international boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing to think about is the necessary and proper clause, as it's outlined in Comstock, which is, you know, you don't have to go back to the 40s, that case is only 10 years old. And there they're talking about the federal power to civilly commit people who have finished serving their federal sentences merely because they were at one point in federal custody. And if you look at the founding, this idea that we would attach federal law, even federal criminal law, to the actions of US citizens abroad is not crazy. There were laws at the time of the founding that did this. The 1789 Crime Bill has a treason provision that applies to US nationals wherever in the world. The 1799 Logan Act, which is still in effect, is based on the nationality principle and prohibits private diplomacy by US nationals anywhere in the world. And this idea of the nationality principle of international law goes back to ancient times, to Greek and Roman and Egyptian times.
Let me ask, I'm struggling. I understand the importance of the slippery slope argument because there are dangers and it can help us see the outcome of what we may be talking about. But also here, it seems to me that line drawing is the meat and potatoes of judging. And what we have is law that tells us how to look at this as applied challenge. Look at it on the facts that it has. The question for me is, what tests apply? And I don't think that we can just look at this, in the largest scheme of things in deciding, because we do have tests that our Supreme Court and our circuits have enacted that tell us, how do you make this decision of when the very thing that Judge Kethledge asks is being violated? And what our law says is there has to be in drawing on the commerce concept, because that's the issue here. Is there any commerce going on? Well, is there a substantial relationship to commerce? We know in Rife, they defined that by, did Congress have a rational basis for concluding that the activity would have a substantial effect on commerce? So for our as applied challenge, how do you answer how your case fits within the parameters that we've already established in this arena?
You're exactly right, Your Honor. And I think the way the DC Circuit explains it in the Park case is very analogous here. The facts are almost identical. And we're talking about him engaging in commercial activity. He's accessing these victims through his commercial employment. As far as the record indicates, the abuse occurs during the school day. And then you have this connected to the broader market for child sexual abuse that we have evidence that Congress was aware is driven in large part by Americans traveling abroad. We have other countries asking the United States to get involved here. And I think also you can consider not just the commerce, but the commerce and the treaty working together. That this is we don't have to pigeonhole the power that Congress is exercising. It can be a broader synergy of powers that are working together to effectuate, especially international relations, which is a purely, quintessentially, necessarily federal endeavor.
Ms. Ralston, I think you talked about the crime bill, probably Judiciary Act of 1789, that had some treason provision in there. That treason provision was not an exercise of the Foreign Commerce Clause, you would agree, right? I mean, it's something else.
Yeah, it's something else.
I mean, the Constitution refers to treason a number of times, makes clear that is something that the federal government can prosecute and obviously prescribe. It actually prescribes an evidentiary rule for conviction. So, I mean, that example really doesn't tell us anything about the scope of the Foreign Commerce Clause. The Logan Act, nobody's been prosecuted under that in like centuries, if I recall, right?
It's rarely used, but Mm-hmm. One could say that it's rarely used because it's effective. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is that these demonstrate that the idea of extraterritorial application of US criminal law to US nationals based on the nationality principle of international law was not a crazy foreign idea to the framers. This was something that was established and within the wheelhouse of something they could think of. And the Logan Act, if you think about that, it's not tied to a particular exercised power. It's part of the necessary and proper to effectuate diplomacy and foreign relations, which is inherent in the federal government.
Well, I mean, an act that has lain in desuetude for, you know, two centuries isn't necessarily exhibit A for a robust power of Congress to regulate American citizens overseas. But let me follow up on Judge Strange's question, which is, you know, the issues she raises are very important to this case. I guess I have an antecedent question to that, which is, I'm not seeing in any Supreme Court precedent or precedent from this court a case where the Supreme Court or this court already has in fact extended the Wickard regime, which is of comparatively recent vintage. I mean, when we look back for the, you know, the history of the country, extended the Wickard rule to the Foreign Commerce Clause. I mean, nothing said, I don't think we're bound to say that Wickard applies in this case is frankly what I'm suggesting. And I just obviously want to give you a chance to say, no, you can't do that because you are bound over here.
So I have two responses to that. The first is what the Supreme Court has said about the Foreign Commerce Clause vis-a-vis the Interstate Commerce Clause. And you have Stranahan, Chicago, the University of Illinois case, and Japan Line, which are three cases in which the court has said, the second two about interstate commerce, the third about the Indian Commerce Clause, in that the Foreign Commerce Clause is broader.
Just repeat the names of those cases real quick? Mm-hmm. So I know you're probably referring to like footnote 13 and Japan Airlines.
Mm-hmm. Japan Airlines.
The intimation, you know, penumbras that we've got from that. All right. So we've got Japan Airlines. And what were the other two cases?
So Japan Line, it's actually a shipping case, not an airplane case.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then that's okay. The other one is the Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago. I think it's about tariffs and taxes and whether we can import things. But they say that the Foreign Commerce Clause is broader. And then you have the Indian Commerce cases where Stranahan says that the power to regulate foreign commerce is certainly as efficacious as that to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. And then other cases, Cotton Petroleum and Lara, these are cited in our brief, where they're talking about how the with, you know, that textual language in the Indian Commerce Clause, right, is with as it is in the Foreign Commerce Clause, and how the with, as opposed to the among the several states, indicates a broader, more expansive power. And so I think if you take those statements, even at face value, I don't think you have to read very far to say that the interstate clause or the foreign clause encompasses at least what's in the interstate clause, that it is a bigger circle. And that's what every other court of appeals to have addressed this has also held.
So, you know, I mean, to look at Japan Airlines, I mean, that, you know, here we have a footnote 12 or 13 or whatever, where Justice Blackmun sort of gestures towards the constitutional history and says that, you know, perhaps James Madison thought the Foreign Commerce Clause was greater than the interstate the power was greater than the Interstate Commerce Clause. But I guess this is my bachelor's degree in early American history, I guess, bias. But I mean, the idea that James Madison was contemplating the Wickard regime to the extent he's saying that the Foreign Commerce Clause power is greater than the, I mean, we're talking about the comparison is with two utterly different things. I mean, you know, if James Madison said he thought the Foreign Commerce Clause is greater than the Interstate Commerce Clause, I'm quite certain he was not thinking about what the Interstate Commerce Clause has turned into post-Wicker. And so doesn't that, I mean, if we're going to talk about history as Japan Airlines sort of, you know, intimates, I mean, that would seem to be a pretty obvious historical conclusion that, well, you know, the if we're talking about, you know, if we want to go back to Gibbons v. Ogden as a Commerce Clause power, maybe the point holds, but it doesn't post 1943.
Well, did you, in your list of cases, counsel, were you talking about trustees of the University of Illinois?
Yes.
That was the case you were talking about that does quote Gibbons, but says pretty clearly the principle of duality in our system of government does not touch the authority of the Congress in the regulation of foreign commerce. So I guess the question becomes, are those grounded principles that still can both circumscribe and state the power of the Congress as created through our Constitution that have now been further honed to the tests that we see in Raich? I mean, what is your position on that? It seems to me that the tests we have stated are applicable here, and fairly broadly stated so, particularly since we are in a situation of relating to other foreign sovereigns who have both said that we aren't doing our share of work in the problem that we have helped create across the world with child sexual abuse, and have joined the optional protocol and have requested our assistance and not objected to the law being passed. Do all those things not play into the tests that have been stated in our case law?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I want to point out again the idea that the test here is whether there is any rational relationship between this statute and either foreign commerce or this treaty or the two of them working together. And so you can take that holistic approach and say that based on the evidence we have that Congress had, there is a rational relationship here. And, you know, to go back to the idea about Morrison, I just want to distinguish that this is, you know, to make the commerce connection as in Morrison, this would have to be us arguing that this is commercial because sexual abuse victims need therapy afterwards. And that's not our argument. Our argument is that there is a thriving market, a commercial market for the sexual exploitation of children, particularly in countries like Cambodia, and that the non-commercial or cases where we cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that money changed hands, sexual exploitation of minors is part of that market, the same way that Raich and Wickard say that the, you know, purely local production is part of the market, the way that this court has said that child pornography, even produced in one person's home, is part of the market. So I think that there's ample space in those, in fact, that all of these precedents together compel the conclusion that this statute is constitutional, especially when we're talking about the deference owed to Congress, both in terms of the constitutionality of statutes and in the foreign relations realm, where the nation needs to speak with one voice.
Let me ask you just
one quick
question. Go ahead, Jane.
Does it matter here that we know scientifically that that child sex abuse in grooming techniques is related to the passage of consideration that is not usually considered consideration in commerce? It's not the purchase and payment for a sexual favor. It is the provision of consideration that is in fact consideration in gifts and promises and grooming techniques and help with family. I mean, this is the classic situation in child sexual abuse. Doesn't that play into why it is in fact implicating commerce?
Yes, I would say that's precisely right. As the DC Circuit explained in the Park case, that we're talking about closing these loopholes where there is, you know, the treaty is talking about any form of consideration, which I think does encompass that type of grooming that you're talking about, but that's not encompassed within the 2423B need to prove quid pro quo beyond a reasonable doubt. And so here we're closing the loopholes, we're trying to make a comprehensive regulatory system, And I would point out, if we're looking at the market, that it's not unusual for defendants to engage in both commercial and non-commercial conduct. In the Bianchi case from the Third Circuit involves both. Clark, the Ninth Circuit case, is technically a commercial case, but implies that the defendant did both in its discussion of the facts. The Reed case out of the DC District Court, the defendant committed both incest and child prostitution, paid for child prostitution. So this isn't some made up link that the markets are connected, that the pedophilic urges.
In consideration of the scientific evidence that children who are abused often become prostitutes or engage in the sex trade as a result of what they experienced as children.
Yes, and I think that that takes the link one step further, but that also reinforces the commercial nature of the entirety of the market.
Yeah, Ms. Ralston, I think all of us would stipulate that the crimes we're talking about are horrible crimes, just for the record, all right? and I don't have any disagreement with Judge Strange's, most of what she just said there. And I think everyone would agree that Congress can regulate the channels of commerce and say that those channels of commerce cannot be used to commit these terrible crimes, which, you know, are in fact being committed. I mean, no question about it. But I get, you know, again, this case, this is a fascinating case because it goes to the question, you know, are the federal government's powers limited or not? Are they limited or are they absolute? And so my question is, let's take it out of this particular sort of, you know, provocative context. And let's just say generically, there's some offense, you know, some kind of financial crime or something dry and boring, which Americans who want to participate in this criminal activity, they actively use the channels of foreign commerce, travel, and they go over and do whatever financial crimes in different places. But is it with respect to trying to stop that crime, is there a limit on and is there a limit to Congress's power with respect to bringing criminal cases? Let's say, you know, you have people, Americans overseas, who at some point commit these financial crimes. All right. And obviously prior to that, they travel. Is there any limit to the government's ability to prosecute any American overseas who has traveled to get there to commit these crimes? I mean, so the American travels, say the American has never even heard of this crime before. The American travels without any intent to commit a crime. The American goes over there and resides there. And I know, you know, that maybe isn't exactly the government's view of the facts of this case, but, you know, is there a limit to how long after the American becomes an expatriate and moves over there and then later commits this offense, 20 years later? I mean, can the government still swoop in and say, well, you know, this is a terrible thing. We got to close all the loopholes and, you know, this is necessary and proper and just no breathing space, et cetera, de facto absolute power. Can they come in 20 years later and prosecute the person?
So I have two responses. The first is that the Supreme Court's decision in Blackmere suggests the answer is yes.
Okay.
They say that by retaining your U.S. citizenship, you retain the obligations of citizenship, which is that you have allegiance to the United States and the laws of the government apply to you. The second is that I agree with you that the federal government is a government of limited powers. I just think this is within the limit. And that's because the limit is not tiny. It's a big limit, but it is a limit. And the limit is the scope of the necessary and proper clause, which if you look at Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Raich, he's talking about what's necessary and proper, what's to effectuate the regulatory regime. And so he's saying, yes, like you can close the loopholes, because if leaving the loopholes makes the regulation ineffective, then there's more that could be done. And I think that is another important point, that this is about what could be done, not about what must be done. And so, you know, especially when we're talking about the treaty sets a floor, not a ceiling. It's talking about as a minimum, and that this, you know, closing the loopholes, closing the gaps is part of fulfilling the entirety of the U.S., you know, not international law obligation in a international law sense, but of their, you know, what the treaty is envisioning countries doing to solve the problem. And you see that in the dialogue between the United States and the United Nations about its implementation of the optional protocol.
Okay.
And Justice Scalia included both the expanse and the restriction in his comment when he said, the relevant question is simply whether the means chosen are reasonably adapted to the attainment of a legitimate end under the commerce power, which would mean that sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Is that correct?
Right.
And the position simply here is that as applied challenge, this is one of those that's a legitimate end.
Certainly. And I think that even if you want to say that not every prosecution under this statute is within the limit, this prosecution certainly is. And that's the rational relationship, again, where Congress doesn't have to make explicit findings. They don't have to invoke an explicit power. And it's up to the court to determine whether that rational relationship exists, giving due deference to Congress.
Okay, any further questions? All right, Ms. Ralston, I think on behalf of all of us, we want to thank you for your very, very thoughtful answers and patience with a lot of questions coming your way. So thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Inman for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a few things that were said. The idea that the Constitution granted was a shift from the Articles of Confederation to grant the federal government authority in the sphere of foreign commerce is about speaking with one voice. And as Judge Hart said in the 10th Circuit, it's not about giving the federal government a megaphone. So how much power are we giving when we say that in relation to the states, the federal government controls foreign commerce? That's really what the issue is.
I understand your sentiment. What's really causing me to be against your, or at least inclined to be against your client's position is this Missouri v. Holland case. How are you going to distinguish that case? How can we as lower court judges get around that case? Because it seems to me, at least it's being interpreted to allow for the federal government to enter into treaties to do things that it couldn't do otherwise without the treaty.
Well, there's two things. One, Missouri v. Holland was another issue about the states exercising a power that was reserved to the federal government. It doesn't say anything about, a U.S. citizen abroad or the scope of the Foreign Commerce Clause with respect to a U.S. citizen abroad. The other issue is that if you're talking about treaties that are implemented, the treaty that was implemented here has nothing to do with the Non-Commercial Sex Act. There's an entirely separate treaty, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that does address that the government expressly decided not to join. And when the Precursor Act.
Before you go off on that point, Mr. Inman, yes, I'm just trying to keep up with the conversation here. So what sentence in Missouri v. Holland are we talking about here? I'm looking at it, but I'm struggling to see the sentence that purports to give the government absolute power to agree to anything it wants with respect to the regulation of Americans overseas. I see a reference to valid treaties, but what sentence are we talking about? Just so I can understand what the issue is.
I don't see that, Your Honor. I mean, Missouri v. Holland says that a treaty cannot be valid if it infringes the Constitution, that there are limits, therefore, to the treaty-making power. It doesn't describe what those are, and it can't derogate powers reserved to the states. It can't violate other provisions of the Constitution. So there are limits on the treaty power. And even Missouri v. Holland recognizes that. My point is that in a typical fashion, Missouri v. Holland is another case involving a state attempting to assert a power that is reserved to the federal government. So you have a dispute about the powers of the states versus the federal government. The same applies in Japan Line. It's a dormant foreign commerce clause case where we're dealing with how we measure the power of the federal government versus the states. They don't address the situation where a treaty is enacted and whether we're using international principles of, you know, the universal principle or the protective principle. Any of those principles could be argued to reach U.S. citizens wherever they are. And that's just not, we have a limited federal government. That's just not how the Constitution works. So, you know, we talk about whether or not there's a treaty that's enacted. The optional protocol deals with commercial acts. This is an as-applied challenge. There's nothing commercial about this conduct. The suggestion that Mr. Reif was grooming or doing any of this stuff is not in the record of this case.
The PSR and the recommendation, sentencing recommendation, had statements about traveling to a different country to assist in concealment of the instant offense, began working in an elementary school to provide himself with easy access to vulnerable victims. And my reading of the record is that Reif did not object to the factual statements in the PSR, and so isn't he bound to them?
Well, the facts are that he was hired by that school. He was not.
Well, the facts are, counsel, if it's written in the PSR and there is no objection, then that's considered a fact of the case, isn't it?
It's also a fact of the case that the government agreed that this was non-commercial conduct. And even if there was some instance of grooming or there's nothing suggesting inchoate favors or anything like that, but if there's some instance of grooming or anything like that, it doesn't rise to the level of commerce. I think in the Sebelius case recently, the Supreme Court said that the fact that you transact business using U.S. dollars, or you have a bank account, or you do all these other things, does not give the federal government power over you from cradle to grave. So not every act is a commercial act. And that's certainly what Morrison says, is that violent offenses such as the ones we're talking about here today, are not commercial acts. In Lopez, it was the same thing. We're looking at possession of a gun within however many feet of a school. Not a commercial act. You might suggest that these are criminal acts, but they're not commercial. And I do want to address Park briefly, if I may. In Park, the DC Circuit struggled with the Foreign Commerce Clause issue, just as I can tell this panel is struggling with it. But they did note that child sexual abuse may not be quintessentially economic in every case. So I appreciate that the government believes that this case is similar to Park, but the gentleman in Park was using a tutoring service. He was advertising a tutoring service to attract victims. That's not the situation here. And that seems to be in an as-applied challenge in Park, that seems to be the tipping point for that court as to why it was commercial. But even they acknowledged that not every case involving sexual abuse of a child is commercial.
Okay, any further questions? All right, Mr. Inman, I don't have in front of me this morning. Were you appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, I want to enthusiastically thank you for your service. You did a remarkably good job in this case, both in your briefing and in your argument. And I would say that is true for the government as well. And so on behalf of the panel, I want to thank you, Mr. Inman, for your service to our rule of law, and both of you for your assistance to us in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Well, we'll give it a very careful look. Case will be submitted.